it's taught that Shakyamuni Buddha once predicted that the next Buddha would be Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha of love. And since I heard this, I oftentimes contemplate it as an inspiration for the continuation of my metta practice. That sense that there is a being in process, in time, that will emerge with such a mind, inspires my humble practice. The thought that a mind could, in fact, be completely and totally informed and motivated by love. I personally don't have the illusion that this mind will ever be completely and totally motivated by love. That's not the aspiration in this life. Instead, it's the intention, as mentioned last evening, to cultivate the consciousness that allows for purity of heart, at least at an intentional level. And something associated with this as well is that with greater concentration and awareness and wisdom, we are much more thorough in our process. Therefore, there's less to fall, let's say, into what's sometimes referred to as the storehouse consciousness. The storehouse consciousness that brings about a sense of being haunted by that which is not consciously motivating us. I like the term haunted, in fact, that there are those feelings within our heart that we don't understand. We don't understand how it is that our character is shaped and our destiny takes form in the way that it does. And so much of this is because of the fact that without mindfulness, there's unrequited experiences that remain latent or dormant in the storehouse consciousness until the conditions are ripe for them to arise again and be resolved. What seems to me to be a much more realistic aspiration in this life is to develop the quality of consciousness that is more thorough. And metta is actually an aspect of this consciousness that allows for us to care enough, to be tender enough, in order to be thorough in our relationship with ourselves, to really come to understand what our own experience is, what the truth of our own experience is, and therefore to be able to see into and honor the truth of another. Love has a practical purpose in this sense. Because without metta, we're leaving ourselves vulnerable to the fact that there is a radically important aspect of our consciousness that's missing. What's ironic about this is that metta is kindred to our nature. In fact, this was demonstrated one time by the Dalai Lama in a gathering with him at Naropa that I was privileged to attend. he made a very simple statement that it is natural for human beings to be affectionate with one another. And there was something in that statement that shocked me, because I was hearing that there was a human being that registered this as a kind of standard way of being. And yet, in that moment, there was a study in contrast with my actual experience, that affection is not generally what we can count upon. A part of the reason that the Dalai Lama, or one like the Dalai Lama, is able to make such a statement, it said, because that the mind of metta holds all being as dear. And so it just seems odd that that connection born of that perception of dearness isn't something ordinary for us. And in fact, underneath the layers and layers and layers of defensiveness, it is natural. But for some reason, we experience it as vulnerable, and we choose the defensiveness in order not to be hurt. And this kind of configuration that I just shared with you flashed through my mind that, oh, that which is natural is not natural for us because of our fear of being hurt. Because that natural flowering of the heart, the open heart, the vulnerable heart, the heart that's able to feel and to transmit this quality of kindness, is constricted with fear. So one who can make such a simple statement is one that is relatively free of fear. The first time that metta appears in the suttas is when the Buddha sent a group of monks to practice in an area that he envisioned, divined, as auspicious for practice. And so this group of monks went to practice in this forest area and were there for quite some time, until it's said that the tree spirits became intolerant of their presence. And so they began to try to create aversion in their minds by producing all kinds of unpleasant conditions, sounds, smells, visions, which roused fear. And so out of this fear, this group of mendicants returned to the Buddha and said, this is not an auspicious place to practice. It was a horrible place to practice. It's not a place that one can practice at all. And the Buddha said, well, effectively, it won't be until you return and practice metta. And so the story goes on that the Buddha offered the practice of metta as the antidote to fear. And these monks returned to this very same location and sat down with the practice of metta. And soon, instead of hostility, the tree spirits began to feel affection for these monks, and in fact began to serve them. When I first heard this story from the suttas, it represented something very important to me, which is that we can't actually know our own world. We can't know ourselves, we can't know one another, until we practice metta. It's as if we have to return to the same place, this body, this heart, this breath, the house that we live in, the people that we live with, those that we associate with, our co-workers. Even the way that we perceive those that we view at a distance, we have to return to all of this and cultivate metta. Because otherwise we are not seeing clearly. We are perceiving our lives through the veil of fear. And so this is another aspect that inspires the metta practice. When I feel that there is fear or ill will present, there's a kind of skepticism, a healthy skepticism that arises that says, what would it be like if metta were practiced? What would the shift in perception be? This kind of healthy skepticism that comes with the understanding that whatever mind state is dominant in any given moment colors perception. And metta helps us to see how fear operates within us. And as I say that, I think, oh goodness, this is enough of a reason to practice metta in order for us to be able to see how fear operates within us, the mechanisms of fear. Because otherwise we will continue to be informed by fear. Fear, I have learned, is our greatest interpreter. It'll interpret every situation in a way that turns it towards darkness and restriction and disconnection and isolation. Metta allows for us to begin to listen to the voice of fear, to see what it's saying to us, so that we're no longer tricked by it. Because metta has the capacity, as an aspect of intelligence, to counter that fear with clarifying information. So one of the motivations for the metta practice is to be able to become familiar with that which obstructs metta, rather than just living in that obstructive state of mind. I remember one time as a young woman that I had the thought, and I may have even said it to somebody, that I had no fear. And, of course, it was a completely delusionary statement, but the reason I thought I had no fear was because of the fact that somehow, since I was a child, I had been sort of battling with fear. And so I used to do kind of bizarre things sometimes to prove to myself that I had no fear. One of the things that I enjoyed doing, you know, when we would go to the Oregon coast, where my family had property, there are these very turbulent waters and there are lots of undercurrents. And so I'd go out swimming until I'd catch one of the undercurrents that would sweep me out into the ocean. And then I would battle my way back against the current. Somehow that was fun. But really what it was foolishness. It was this unconscious pride that was a karmic dimension of my karma that said, I will win against fear. And therefore, I remember the day that I said, I have no fear, because somehow I convinced myself of it. I had won all the fear battles. And then I remember one of the first meditation retreats I ever did, where I was in an interview with the teacher, one of the teachers of the retreat, and while we were talking about the practice, my body began to shake. And it began to reverberate. And so this kind teacher said, "Why don't you just go outside for a while?" And I remember walking into the woods. The impulse was that I had to get away from everything and everybody because everything was dangerous. And I went out to the woods and I lay down with that sense of perhaps I can calm myself. But instead, it was as if that energy of fear almost lifted my body off of the earth. It was as if the vibration was in the very marrow of my bones. And even though it wasn't conscious, it was a corrective moment. A moment that kind of just cleared all that delusion that I don't have fear. And reoriented the sense of awareness in a way that opened to this unavoidable, undeniable reality that fear existed so deep that it was at a cellular level. I remember during that same retreat sitting in a chair in the room that I was staying in and just kind of rocking back and forth and just kind of inquiring, what is this? And what came to mind was just this repeated statement over and over again, I am so afraid. I am so afraid. I am so afraid. But it felt like it was a gift of the practice to come in touch with this level of fear. First at the physical level, and then at the mental level. And to be able to hear and to perceive and to know the depths and the dimensions of his experience. And from that point on, I went from one extreme to the other. I began to have a deeper respect for this humanity, a deeper love for this humanity, this being, this body, because of its vulnerability. And began to learn slowly over time that this fear was not self, but an existential condition, like others I've mentioned, that arise with birth. It's an existential condition. And only metta can provide the conditions to meet this fear completely. There's this beautiful poem that goes, that life itself is dependent upon reoccurring cycles until they're met from within. The thousandth time may prove the charm. Well, I have increased that number from the thousandth time to the millionth time or to the billionth. May prove the charm. Because it's about the capacity to meet something directly with complete receptivity and reverence. Our greatest fear is the fear of fear. So when I think of this being that could possibly be Maitreya, a Buddha, I think of one who has no fear. And that contemplation reaches deeply into other themes that we carry. One for me is the question of honesty. We're so afraid to be honest. One of the ways that we deprive ourselves and one another is by not being able to be honest. One of the reflections on right speech, as well as coming from a place of loving kindness, as well as skillful timing, is to be straightforward, to be able to share information as something that's neutral, just information. And yet we are so tentative about our experience that we all deceive one another constantly. We're afraid to share the truth when in actuality all there is the truth. I'm not saying that this is to suggest that we operate out of a level of unskillfulness so that suddenly I have enough metta to be honest with you and go up to you and say, I don't like you. You know? That's not it. But it's the truth that allows for us to be completely honest with ourselves in a way that then gets processed through such qualities as loving kindness, that allows for us to eventually come into that place of meeting. And it's astounding when I've experimented with the experience or the perception of fear of something or someone, and then brought that perception or sense of the being into place as an object of metta, that the perception, the thinking, as well as the experience of the being completely changes. Because suddenly there's a way of seeing that is not wrought with fear nor with ill will, which is a defensive fear. Metta is usually referred to as the softening of the heart. And the softening of the heart is the melting away of this encasement, this entrapped sense of this heart being closed because of fear. And within that state, then naturally, ill will festers. I've spoken to the sort of mythology of love and how we have, or perhaps have, the expectation of being a perfectly loving being. And to release that perception in favor of being one who has the capacity to recognize that which is unloving, but with a mind of love, is for me a much more realistic and practical view of loving. It's also true that we don't know what love is. We may have an idea of it. It may be an ideal. We may consider it a virtue. But the truth is that we don't know what it is because it's not one thing. So sometimes I feel that it's helpful to put love forward as a question and allow for ourselves to ask in this moment, what is love? Because it can take many forms. It can be soft, it can be receptive, it can be gentle, it can be kind in a way that is characterized by those qualities, or it can be extremely strong and direct from a place of caring. It can even be confrontational. I care about you so much that I have to be honest with you about my experience. I have to confront my actual experience. So metta builds in a kind of courage and strength that allows for us to operate in life in a way that is not governed by fear. And even as I say that, and even though I've experimented with it, it still remains unimaginable for me, because the degree of fear that still exists. But there's a possibility that fear becomes the motivation for metta, so that when it arises, it also becomes the reminder for metta. Oh, here's fear, my friend, reminding me to do metta. It's said that metta and the other Brahma Viharas are the medicines that heal the wounds suffered throughout existence. And our deepest wound is the wound that we inflict upon ourselves over and over and over again because of the reinforcement of the separate sense of self, the perception of self that we experience in what I'll refer to as duality, the self that is not a part, not integrated, but in isolation, the part of self that is not acceptable, the part of self that is held in shame, in guilt, in condemnation, in punishment. Imagine that these forces of separation actually imprison parts of us out of punishment. And oftentimes, this is something that's left over on a karmic level, not necessarily on a conscious level. That process of imprisoning an aspect of oneself is something that one can carry from one life to another. Metta is the practice that can heal wounds suffered throughout existence that live out as expressions of this separate sense of self that has no idea why it's suffering, that has no idea why it's lonely, that has no idea why it feels so unloved. And it's astounding how when metta finds or comes upon one of these separated aspects of self, there's a kind of embrace. An embrace that brings about an integration. There's simply no other way to do this. There's no other way to heal these wounds that live at a subliminal level and manifest into our consciousness. Metta is also a saving grace. I've seen this many times in my ordinary day-to-day life with my children. And I can say that there's a tremendous vulnerability in that relationship between mother and child, and we all know this because we have all been a child. That tenderness of being that no one can perceive, that is so easily hurt, has become apparent to me because of the practice of metta, and there's been these moments of grace where that which would otherwise strike out or impose upon this tenderness has been diverted as a result of the metta, has just kind of dissolved away the aggressiveness, and particularly for me, a sense of an adversarial disapproval that can arise. Just a restlessness that can feel that something is wrong and just projects it into a relationship. Whereas after some metta, that feeling is addressed in a way that then no longer obstructs the intentional quality of mind that we live with. This intention to be kind, to be present, to be able to interact in a way that does not cause harm, is astounding. How insensitive we are without the quality of metta. Metta is something that we will practice, if you will, throughout lifetimes. And I think that there's something very beautiful about that. It's not something that we can hurry up and do. But we can dedicate it just to infinite time. May this quality ripen. May this quality awaken. May this quality become dominant over time. And I have found that there is also a grace in this kind of patience, because it allows for a certain kind of forgiveness of oneself. It allows for something that's very difficult, which is to acknowledge, oh, I have made a mistake. Something occurred that was not in accordance with what was intentional. And so one of the things that I have done in relationship and with my children in particular is to speak from this place of that which just happened was not intentional. If it had been intentional, it would have looked like this. And meanwhile, I know that I have caused you harm. And I ask for your forgiveness. It was not something that I intended. It doesn't take away the pain, but it adds a new dimension of possibility that protects us from that conditioning within us associated with perfectionism, that we're not able to acknowledge our mistakes. That's not a part of the way that we interact with one another, because we're supposed to be perfect, and if we admit that we're not, then I don't know what's going to happen. Something terrible. Even the pretense of perfection is better than acknowledging the truth of one's imperfection. And then there have been moments when this kind of communication has happened where I've had a sense of a glowing heart that rather than teaching perfectionism and passing that on as a conditioning, that we can teach, we can share the possibility of a kind of truth that includes forgiveness. The forgiveness that comes out of the understanding born of the distinction between that which is intentional and that which does come out of unconsciousness and out of habit and is not personal. And there's a huge distinction between that. That sense that I have hurt or been hurt by someone in a way that was intentional, or that I have hurt or been hurt by someone in a way that was unconscious. There's a huge distinction. And that distinction makes a very significant difference in the way that we relate to one another. Metta also has a certain magnetic power, meaning that there's a magnetism associated with it and a quality of transformational potential in that magnetism. And there are some wonderful stories about the Buddha that are demonstrations of this. You may or may not know that the Buddha had an enemy. For his entire life, he had an enemy. from his childhood. It was a cousin. And this cousin's name was Devadatta. And this cousin was always jealous of this young prince, Siddhartha, and always causing him problems and always trying to put him in a position of blame so that he would not be seen as such a radiant and wonderful young child. And this force of jealousy grew throughout their lives and existed, in fact, when Devadatta was actually a renunciate, a monk in the Buddhist assembly. He was addicted to this quality of ill will for the Buddha, so much so that he had almost always to be in his presence. And so, as that jealousy grew, there are certain stories that emerge, such as the time that he decided that he would intoxicate an elephant. This reminds me of my story of blowing up my friend's sailboat. He would intoxicate an elephant, and then he would wait until the right moment and release this elephant in a state of rage upon the Buddha. And that therefore the Buddha would be trampled. Clearly he was not investigating the state of jealousy and anger. He was actually manifesting it through thought and through intention, which is extremely unfortunate. And so the moment came, and this rageful and intoxicated elephant with these huge tusks, it said, was released upon the Buddha. And because of the fact that metta is a response to fear, and because of the extraordinary power of metta in the Buddha's mind, there was an immediate radiation of loving kindness upon viewing this suffering creature. And as the creature approached, the magnetism, the power of the metta healed the conditions that were present, that were meant to cause harm. And it said that the Buddha, that the elephant fell upon his knees in front of the Buddha. I love this story because I feel that in small ways, I have experienced this, just in tiny little ways, just experimentally. Because so much of what is dangerous to us is born of our own perception. And therefore, at times, if I'm aware that I'm afraid of someone, and there doesn't necessarily have to be any particular cause, then it becomes an interesting experiment if I know that this individual is going to be somewhere or I'm going to have some reason to be in touch with them, to just cultivate metta to see then how that will shift the perception. And it does. I've seen it over and over again where one who was perceived in fear as dangerous suddenly becomes perceived with affection. We can't analyze this mind that perceives with fear. Not to any true resolution. But by becoming more aware of when fear is present, then we can begin to transform the fear through metta. And again, I mean from a place of experimentation. What would it be like to do metta in this particular instance? Sometimes just the physical, energetic experience of restlessness can lead to a mind of ill will. And I've seen this in myself, where I'm with a friend and suddenly there's just discomfort in the body and the perception of the individual changes, and suddenly the mind becomes critical. And there's that sense of, why is this happening? It can be so disconcerting. And instead, there's a potential right there, right in that very moment, to protect the mind and to protect the actual moment of the social engagement from turning sour by bringing metta to bear. I call this practical metta because it's hard for us to see our way in the dark without stumbling and falling and colliding with one another without the light of this particular quality. But it's up to us to turn the light on. When I refer to mindfulness as participatory awareness, maybe you can see how this is represented in the way that I'm conveying practical metta. The sense of living with the Dhamma in a way that we engage in any given moment of life, not just on retreat, but because we are concentrating the force of metta here on retreat, it will become easier for us and more interesting and viable for us to actually experiment in this way. Because again, there will be the sensitivity, the increasing sensitivity, to when fear exists and when ill will exists, which will then inspire the possibility of experimenting with the cultivation of metta. Because fear is such an immediate reaction to things. And when we understand that it doesn't represent the truth of who we are, and that we have the potential to shift into the light of that which is authentic and genuine and intentional for us, why not? Why would we miss that opportunity? The exemplar of metta is very dear. It's a suggested contemplation that we come in touch with the essence of metta by contemplating the relationship between the mother and child, that utter and complete tenderness of being. And in the Metta Sutta, in fact, it's said that it is suggested that we maintain this quality of mind while standing, while walking, while sitting and while lying down, and while moving in all directions. And in a certain way, this can be done in a formal manner, but this movement in all directions is, in a less formal manner, just the natural process of the body moving about in life. One time I decided to take a day of metta, but I decided to do it in an active way, not in a silent retreat manner, although I think that that's a very wonderful thing to do. It's just a part of life to take days out of the week, a day out of the week, maybe a day each week, and spend some time in silence and practice. But instead, this was the day when I decided to take a drive, and I decided to take the mind of metta with me. And so there was just this taking off into the country kind of experience, and kind of stopping along the way and just saying, okay, well, what is the perception in this moment of this experience, of this person, or of this tree, or of this field? And to just kind of take the metta practice on a little trip like you might one of your children. And I found myself at a park, and I'd always wanted to go up this drive, and because I knew that there was a not a lookout tower, but a place that you could climb and look out at the countryside and at the mountains. And so I climbed this and I got to the top, and there was this wonderful walk in a circle around at the top. So then I decided, oh, okay, this is perfect. Offering metta in all directions. And so there was just a few steps of walking meditation with metta in mind, and then opening the eyes to whatever was in front of me. And it was this kind of vast panorama of nature. And then just doing metta for a few moments, and then doing a few moments of walking meditation further around a few feet, stopping, and then continuing with the metta until, having come full circle, about three quarters of the way through, I got bored. You know, I thought, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, it was sort of like, I want to go now and have something good to eat. But there was a sense that it would be a missed opportunity, and so I continued around the full circle. I closed that gap. I'm glad I did, because I keep finding that gap in my mind, that place of withdrawal, that place that says, I'm bored with this. I'm bored with the mind-liberating practice of metta. And its potential freedom, and, you know, from fear and ill will. I want a popsicle. And so the decision to come completely around that circle has served me many, many times. So one of the habits that I've formed is that when I'm landing in an airplane and I'm looking out the window, it's a very wonderful opportunity to do metta for all beings. Because how often are we elevated to that height that the mind can expand like that? All the little houses, all the little cars, you know, all of the little lights if it's dark. And then the mind opens to the imperceptible sense of the beings that exist within that range of the visual field. Not just the ones that are somewhat apparent. And the mind can see into the world in that way that's very, very penetrating for moments. With a sense that, yes, this practice is very powerful. It can reach into the darkness. And it can touch every human being that exists. At times that sounds very poetic, and at times it seems very true. So these are just a few reflections on the kind of fun that you can have with the practice of metta. So my inspiration for us this evening is that we continue, those of us that are cultivating it, or maybe even those who have continued with the mindfulness, the embodiment of mindfulness in Vipassana. Perhaps just taking a few moments to cultivate metta so that we can enjoy the process of living with a mind that experiences the practical and creative dimensions of this practice, so that we can have fun with it. I call this divine play. Yes, we are doing that for ourselves. For who else is it that's capable of cultivating it, awakening it, and ripening it to a mind state in which one is capable of abiding? And to close, there is a lesser known Metta Sutta, and it goes like this. May those with no legs not harm me. May those with two legs not harm me. May those with four legs not harm me. May those with many legs not harm me. May I not harm those with no legs. May I not harm those with two legs. May I not harm those with four legs. May I not harm those with many legs. May I live in metta, free from harm. May all beings live in metta, free from harm.